Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's next lawmaking session is months away, but already state agency heads are turning to trust funds to cover operations in the coming year.
So that is all spending authority is currently out of trust funds, so there's no general revenue associated with this.
Also this week, water quality, more accurately, the lack of water quality, is becoming a political hot potato in the Sunshine State.
We can see toxins being produced that can impact aquatic life. So there's a domino effect, if you will.
We'll also delve into the latest efforts to revamp Florida's criminal justice system, including ways to prevent convicts from reoffending after their release, and learn the latest on the greening disease that's devastating the state's citrus crops. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Politicians can make soaring promises and have the very best of intentions when it comes to meeting pressing public needs. But if the money isn't there, not much will get done. Florida's 2017 lawmaking session isn't set to kick off until early March, but already there are dark clouds on the budget-making horizon. Florida's cabinet recently got its first look at state agency budget requests this week. Nick Evans reports with revenue projections showing empty state coffers. Those agencies are eyeing state trust funds.
A total of six executive agencies presented budget requests for the coming year at Tuesday's cabinet meeting. But there could be dark clouds hanging over some of those plans. State economists are warning lawmakers money is beginning to run short, and next year's budget may be in for some serious belt tightening.
Well, we're certainly sensitive to the situation there, but we think that with the regulatory trust being the condition that it's in, it's a minimal budget request, so we're optimistic. But of course, we understand the key decisions that the legislature has to make.
That's David Altmaier, the new head of the Office of Insurance Regulation. He's asking for $31.6 million. It's about $700,000 more than the current year, but like he said, the money comes from a trust fund, not the general revenue pool where forecasters are projecting a shortfall. Altmaier says the bulk of the money would go towards salary increases for low-level employees.
What we would like to do is make sure that some of those folks that come in into the entry-level OAR positions have some incentive to stay around. I mean, they develop skills that are critical for a regulator to have, and when they leave, we have to develop somebody else.
Other agencies are emphasizing their reliance on trust funds instead of general revenue as well.
So that is all spending authority is currently out of trust funds, so there's no general revenue associated with this.
That's Terry Rhodes, the director of Florida's Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. Rick Swearingen heads up the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and he is asking for $12 million out of the shrinking general revenue fund. But he has a backup plan.
Well, I ask for what we need. The crafting of the, you know, where the money comes from falls on the legislature, but we do have an ability to shift some of that funding to our operating trust fund. So that's the good news. Yes, general revenues may be down, but we can shift some of that to our operating trust fund.
Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel David Sutphin of the Department of Veterans Affairs is asking for a little more than $8 million in general revenue, with the bulk of it going to two veterans' homes.
I'm certainly not going to take money away from starving children or families in need out through there. But we'll find a way maybe through our trust fund to move some things around with help from the legislature if I have to do that in order to get this home built for the veterans that have great need. We're supposed to have 4,049 beds. I have 870 beds in the state of Florida.
Securing those funds will be important, especially for FDLE and Veterans Affairs. In the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting, FDLE's Swearingen is hoping to hire 46 new counterterrorism officers. On the veterans' home issue, the federal government is ready to nearly double the state investment, but not until Florida Annie's up. There's still a long way to go before the budget process begins in earnest, and agency requests could still shift. What's more, the governor and the legislature will have their chance to weigh in on agency expenditures, with lawmakers deciding who gets what. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
But before Florida legislators meet, there's something called an election to contend with. State candidates and advocacy groups in Florida have made water a central issue in this year's elections. One big debate deals with Lake Okeechobee and what to do with polluted water flowing into and out of the lake. From member station WGCU in Fort Myers, Topher Forges takes a look at both sides of the question as part of Florida Public Radio's statewide series on election issues.
Coffee-colored water gurgles near the Franklin Dam and flows down the Caloosahatchee River, roughly 30 miles from Fort Myers. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is releasing this water from Lake Okeechobee so it doesn't overflow. But Jennifer Hecker with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida says this water contains pollutants called nutrients. She says they can intensify the algal blooms plaguing beaches and waterways in parts of South Florida.
It can also feed red tide offshore and cause that to be more frequent and severe. And as a result of those harmful algae, we can see toxins being produced that can impact aquatic life. So there's a domino effect, if you will.
That effect also has an economic side. Coastal communities that are heavily dependent on fishing and tourism have already taken financial losses. Before the Everglades were drained and settled, water flowed through marshes from the lake down to the bottom of the state. Now, a massive man-made system of canals steers, holds, and treats water. Everglades restoration plans are gaining momentum, but environmentalists say they're not enough. Political hopefuls like U.S. House Democratic candidate Tim Canova have picked up their cause.
Water. It's our most precious resource, and the future of Florida depends on it.
Canova lost in the primary, but the idea he and others support is for the state to buy land below Lake Okeechobee. Water would be stored and treated there before heading into Everglades National Park. A recent proposal by incoming Florida Senate President Joe Negron would buy thousands of acres of agricultural land for this purpose. The thing is, people live and work in that region. Farmer Alan Hammock uses a machete to cut a tall green sugarcane stalk on his Glades County farm.
Probably this stalk has had a little bit of wind damage, and probably the plant told itself, said, hey, we're getting ready to die. It's time to start growing again and reproduce.
Hammock runs Frierson Farms. It borders where advocates want the state to buy land. Alan's wife, Artis, says she feels targeted because this area is rural. She says the Everglades also used to encompass what are now more developed parts of South Florida.
What's the difference in telling people there that, I'm sorry, but we shouldn't have built your homes here. It was a mistake, so let's take out 10,000 homes and let's put a reservoir in here.
Artis supports another solution water managers are looking into. It involves storing water farther north before it even gets to Lake Okeechobee. Artis says she feels buying agricultural land in the region could upend the local economy and cause people to lose their jobs.
I love the way of life that's here. For me, I do live in paradise. I do live a sweet life, and I want it to continue.
People in coastal areas feel the same way. They're worried about the continued effects of pollution on their tourism and fishing industries. Jennifer Hecker with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida says if officials wanted to buy the land, there are programs available that could help people south of the lake.
Help train people to be able to give them resources so that they can be able to switch industries, or for local governments who are losing property taxes to be able to receive assistance from the federal government to offset those losses.
This argument is playing out in elections across the state this year. Environmental groups have asked politicians to sign a pledge to support buying land south of Lake Okeechobee. Hecker says this issue should not pit coastal and inland communities against each other. She says they're in this together, that everyone needs clean, fresh water. I'm Topher Forges in Fort Myers.
Well, the first votes are in for the 2016 presidential election in Florida. While more than 2 million residents have requested vote by mail ballots, the Florida Division of Elections reported this morning that 38 vote by mail ballots had been returned to county administrators of elections offices for the November 8 elections. County supervisors have until tomorrow to send out ballots to military personnel and voters overseas. Vote-by-mail ballots will start going out October 4th to people in the state. The deadline to register to vote in the general election is October 1st. As of today, vote-by-mail ballots had been requested by more than 880,000 Republicans, just over 759,000 Democrats, a bit fewer than 50,000 folks signing up with third parties, and a whopping 348,000 people registering without party affiliation. In the August primary, about 1.28 million Floridians voted by mail, with Republicans making up nearly half. Ballots have already been cast in Alachua, Clay, Flagler, Hernando, Indian River, Jackson, Lee, Leon, Monroe, Nassau, and Seminole counties. The Division of Elections, in a news release today, said vote-by-mail ballots must be received by 5 o'clock the afternoon of November 2nd at county elections offices. Vote-by-mail ballots can be obtained at the local elections offices up to the day before the election. Still to come on Capitol Report, this week's James Madison Institute survey was good news for children's advocates who want police to issue civil citations instead of arresting juvenile offenders.
We have superior data that using civil citations brings better results, public safety, use of taxpayer dollars, than making a youth arrest. This is one of the most important juvenile justice reforms that we can make.
Florida prison officials are embarking on a new program to help better rehabilitate the state's offenders.
I don't think that this is something that we've had the opportunity to really use this evidence-based practices, you know, at this level before. So it's super exciting to be able to see the data in a different way and to begin to act on it.
And 99% of Florida's commercial groves are affected by citrus greening. Now Congress is considering a plan to help. This week's survey by the free market-favoring James Madison Institute did more than show widespread support for criminal justice reform. Jim Ash reports it lends more ammunition to children's advocates, pushing greater use of civil citations for juvenile offenders.
Children's advocates were encouraged last legislative session when a House subcommittee tentatively agreed to require police to issue civil citations to juveniles instead of arresting them for minor crimes. If the bill passed, it would have been a big step. Civil citations are optional in Florida and not always popular with police. House Criminal Justice Chairman Carlos Trujillo, a Miami Republican, said mandating civil citations would at least level the playing field.
The consequences of the crime or the punishment that's administered should not be different by circuit, and it should not be different by county. Then a child or an adult arrested in Duval County should be treated the same exact way under the law as a child arrested in Monroe County.
The bill died when a deal between Republican leaders and the Black Caucus fell apart. Now, Children's Campaign President Roy Miller is hoping a new study will rebuild momentum.
We have superior data that using civil citations brings better results, public safety, use of taxpayer dollars, than making a youth arrest. This is one of the most important juvenile justice reforms that we can make.
Civil citations are the middle ground between looking the other way and slapping on the cuffs. Juveniles get them for misdemeanor infractions like tagging a building, shoplifting a T-shirt, or trespassing in a public park. Civil citations come with consequences, like community service and letters of apology. Millers and others say civil citations are important in an age when a minor arrest can haunt someone for life. Young people say they're being barred from college, student housing, and military careers. Tampa-based consultant Dewey Carruthers says advocates are encouraged by the latest figures, but there's still a ways to go. Civil citation use in Florida rose 5% last year, but it peaked at a 42% utilization rate.
So that's the good news. The bad news that means that in 58% of all of those instances where law enforcement confronts someone and has the opportunity to issue a civil citation, an arrest was made.
Civil citations aren't being used uniformly. Miami-Dade leads the state with a 91% utilization rate. Leon County, with a 62% utilization rate, is in the top 13 counties. Orange County ranked near the bottom with a 17% utilization rate. The study doesn't recommend mandatory use of civil citations. But ACLU Florida attorney Howard Simon warns, without a mandate, juvenile offenders are being treated unfairly.
From my point of view, the alarming thing about this report is that there are still too many communities that are jeopardizing the future of young people by saddling them with an arrest record for a nonviolent minor offense.
That's not to mention the bottom line. The report claims raising the statewide utilization rate for civil citations to 75% would save police a combined $62 million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
And while we're on the subject of changes to the way Florida treats those who violate the law, the Florida Department of Corrections is teeing up a new program aimed at making sure released offenders stay out of the state's prison system. As Sasha Cordner reports, prison officials say Spectrum is a research-based program unique to Florida.
Let's say your name was Joe. You've fallen on hard times, and after committing a felony, you are sentenced to 5 years in prison.
In the past, an offender such as Joe would have been subject to a disconnected system that limited his potential rehabilitation. Today, Joe enters a correctional system focused on personal development, improvement, and readiness through science-driven treatment programs.
That's a Florida Department of Corrections video speaking about its new program called Spectrum. Using Joe as an example, it illustrates how the new system will work to help inmates like Joe adjust and successfully reenter society once released. Once the inmate arrives, they go through an assessment interview.
During reception, the Florida Department of Corrections will evaluate Joe's needs in 7 different areas associated with his likelihood to reoffend. These 7 domains are 1. Social awareness, or antisocial personality. 2. Criminal associates. 3. Substance abuse. 4. Family and marital. 5. Wellness. 6. Criminal thinking and attitude. And 7. Employment and education.
And so what was traditionally sort of a 5 to 10 day process has now turned into a month-long process.
That's Abe Uccello, the Director of Development, Improvement, and Readiness for the Florida Department of Corrections. He also leads Spectrum, which Uccello says is unique to Florida.
Other states are doing risk and needs assessments, and they're maybe using a homegrown tool, or maybe they're using, you know, an off-the-shelf product from one of the 3 or 4 vendors that exist out there. What we're doing is we're actually measuring the information and mapping programs and treatment to that information before, during, and after the incarceration process. And that is unique to Florida.
Uccello says Spectrum first started off as a pilot project. It began in January for those on probation supervision in 3 judicial circuits and then later circulated to parts of the prison system in March.
In prison, we ran 2 separate pilots. We ran one at Central Florida Reception Center, which is our largest intake facility, and then also at the Florida Women's Reception Center so that we could also, you know, have a really balanced approach for the female population.
Florida prison officials have now started the process of implementing Spectrum throughout the whole prison system. Uccello says they hope to finish training everyone and having it fully operational by December 2017. While everyone will be assessed, Uccello says officials plan to focus more on inmates who have the highest needs or highest risk of reoffending. And while they continue to monitor those from the Spectrum pilots, Uccello says prison officials don't yet have complete data.
Folks that come into prison have an average of about a 4.5-year stay. And so in the past 6 months, we haven't had anybody go through the process and immediately leave.
According to Prison Chief Julie Jones, a goal of the Spectrum program is to lower the inmate population, which is currently at 98,000. That's one of the goals incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran set for the prison agency at the end of this year's legislative session, when Jones had asked for more funds to take care of understaffing levels. That issue also took center stage recently when several North Florida prisons were on lockdown because of riots, and Governor Rick Scott says he'll make sure staffing is again a priority in his budget for next year.
First off, I think Julie Jones does an outstanding job. I think she has really high standards. You know, we've gone through we'll propose things this legislative session to continue to help her make sure she can do her job. I want everybody that works at a prison to be safe. And that includes everybody that works there, and plus everybody that's in these prisons. I want them all to be safe.
Meanwhile, a new poll by the James Madison Institute and the Charles Koch Institute shows a majority of Floridians want state lawmakers to keep taking a comprehensive approach to criminal justice reform. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Homeschooling entered the mainstream in the 1980s and was championed largely by white evangelical Christians. Today, the U.S. Department of Education says about 1.7 million students in the U.S. are homeschooled, 80,000 of them in Florida. And as Kathy Carter from member station WUSF in Tampa reports, the fastest growing demographic to leave traditional schools behind are African Americans.
Art projects are scattered on the floor of L'Oreal Holloway's sunny apartment in downtown St. Petersburg, and an entire living room wall is lined with children's books. Seated at a long table, 6-year-old Nadia and her sister Ava, age 4, listen attentively as their mother teaches them about vowel sounds.
Your turn to say the sound when I touch under it.
Ah.
Good job. Again, get ready.
Ah.
Good.
There are a lot of reasons why Holloway is homeschooling her girls. Some echo sentiments of the homeschooling movement in general. She wants to give them individualized attention and foster their interests, like Nadia's penchant for gardening.
We use seeds and soil and water, and the sun is shining.
But there's more behind Holloway's decision to seek an alternative to traditional education. A month before Nadia was to enter first grade, the Tampa Bay Times published a scathing 5-part series on failing schools in Pinellas County. Holloway says the report felt like validation. She was doing the right thing.
I feel that being a black child in America, they may feel inferior. I don't really care for them to feel superior, but I want them to feel equal to all people.
According to new federal education data, black and Latino students have less access to high-level math and science courses in the nation's public schools and are more likely to attend schools with less experienced teachers. More than one-third of bullied adolescents say race was an issue. Cheryl Field Smith is a professor of elementary education at the University of Georgia and has written about black family engagement and learning. She says black home education can combat institutionalized racism.
Black children, males in particular, are more harshly disciplined. The most recent report that came out demonstrates that this happens as early as pre-K. How long should parents accept their children being labeled troublemakers?
For Paula Penn-Nabrit, an African-American author of a book on black homeschooling, the issue is personal. In the 90s, she and her husband decided to homeschool their 3 sons after racial incidents at public and private schools. That experience and a lack of black teachers made them worry about their son's self-esteem. She points to Department of Education data that less than 7% of the nation's teachers are African-American.
And for a lot of black children, particularly for a lot of black boys, it's possible for them to go from grades K through 12 without ever having a teacher who is an adult version of themselves.
Back in St. Petersburg, homeschooling mom L'Oreal Holloway agrees and adds that she wants to model a positive image of race. In a school setting, she says, even if her girls weren't picked on, other kids of color around them may be.
I don't want that for Nadia and Ava, and we really work on like the emotional intelligence and high self-esteem and, you know, I'm good at this and it's not all about looks and things like that.
Homeschoolers Nadia and Ava get to see their reflection every day when they look at their teacher, their mom.
Your turn to say the word slowly. Say run.
Run.
Say man.
Man.
Good.
And with that, Ava pulls her favorite book off the shelf for story time. It's Sugar Plum Ballerinas by Whoopi Goldberg, the one about a black preteen protagonist following her dreams. I'm Kathy Carter in Tampa.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, more citrus farmers could be in for tax breaks when they replace trees damaged by citrus greening. Regan McCarthy reports that's under a bill that's making its way through Congress.
Millions of citrus trees in the United States are diseased by a bacteria called citrus greening. And Republican Florida Congressman Vern Buchanan says the infection is having a significant impact on Florida's citrus industry.
While not harmful to human, its results in its bitter, hard, misshapen fruit and eventually causes trees to die.
Buchanan says 99% of Florida's commercial citrus groves are impacted by the disease, and forecasters are predicting greening will have a devastating effect on Florida's citrus industry. A new report from the Florida Citrus Commission projects harvests will decrease by two-thirds in the next decade unless a breakthrough to fight greening is made. Buchanan is pushing a bill he hopes will help in the meantime.
My bill would let farmers bring in investors to help underwrite replanting costs without losing the immediate deduction.
Experts say one way to fight greening is by ripping out infected trees and groves and then replanting with healthy trees. But Buchanan says that's costly. So in order to protect thousands of citrus jobs in Florida and to maintain the agricultural lands, his bill offers an incentive by expanding existing law. Growers who bear the full cost of removing and replanting the trees themselves are already granted a tax deduction. Buchanan's measure would extend that break to farmers using investor money for the process. But during a meeting of the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee, Sandy Levin, a Democratic congressman from Michigan, raised concerns about the precedent the move might set.
Because I don't object to, I think there's a good argument for doing it in this case, but I think we should understand that we may well be setting a precedent that this kind of a situation is not likely to be unique. And so if we're going to do it in this case, I think we should understand its potential impact for the future.
For example, one congressman points out grapes along the West Coast recently faced a significant threat from a disease that attacks vines. But California Congressman Mike Thompson says he thinks creating a precedent isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, this could happen, you're right, to any crop that we're growing for food, any agricultural crop. And if the problem is so severe that it causes folks not to replant an orchard, it could have other externalities that we have to consider. It could be loss of agricultural land to development. I don't think it's a problem that we set that that precedent to make sure that we go on record strongly supporting our agricultural communities.
The measure passed through the U.S. House with a 400-20 vote. The measure is awaiting a hearing in the Senate. Florida Democrat Bill Nelson sponsored that chamber's version of the bill, along with co-sponsor Republican Marco Rubio. In a statement, Rubio urges the Senate to pass the measure, saying he'd like to get the bill to the president's desk as soon as possible. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.